Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday afternoon. In the International New York Times on May 2nd, under the headline, Resettling the First American Climate Refugees, this story. Here's how it begins. Dateline, Île-de-Jean-Charles, Louisiana. Each morning at 3:30, when Joanne Borg leaves the mildewed and rusted house that her parents built on her grandfather's property, she worries that the bridge connecting this spit of waterlogged land to Louisiana's terra firma will again be flooded and she will miss another's day work. She is a custodian at a sporting goods store on the mainland, and she lives with her two sisters, 82-year-old mother, son, and niece, on land where her ancestors, members of the Native American tribes of southeastern Louisiana, have lived for generations. That earth is dying. It's drowning in salt and sinking into the sea, and she is ready to leave. That area is now the first of its kind in a climate resilience grant to resettle the island's native residents. Washington is ready to help. In January, the Department of Housing and Urban Development announced grants totaling $1 billion in 13 states to help communities adapt to climate change by building stronger levees, dams, and drainage systems. And the thing that's happening in Île-de-Jean-Charles is something new because it's the first allocation of federal dollars to move an entire community struggling with the impact of climate change. This hour, we're going to have three guests with us to talk not only about what's going on in that community, but what's happening with having to move people because of climate change all over the world. We'll have three guests with us, and we start with Dr. Cosmin Corenda. He works as Associate Academic Office and Legal Expert at the UN University Institute for Environment and Human Security, which is located in Germany. He's joining us from Germany by phone. He's acting as a focal point for legal issues associated with environmental degradation and adverse effects of climate change, and his research interests include climate change, human rights, and migration. Later in the hour, we'll speak with Marion McFadden, who is the Deputy Assistant General, Assistant Secretary for Grant Programs at the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. And still later, we'll speak with the Deputy Chief of the Biloxi Chitimaca Choctaw Tribe from Louisiana. Welcoming your phone calls the whole hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Dr. Cosmin Corenda, thank you very much for being with us. Good afternoon. Oh, maybe you're on this line. Doctor, are you there?
Yes.
Yes, okay. Can you hear me? Absolutely, perfectly, clearly.
Like Good afternoon, Kathleen. Thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you so much for being with us. You have a worldwide perspective on this issue. Can you tell us how many people have already been very negatively impacted by climate change, and what can we expect in the decades ahead?
Well, even for scientists, this is very hard to predict. The number New York Times mentioned in its article, it's a number from 2009, and it was an estimate. However, since then, the science improved, and we don't know for sure how many people migrated so far due to climate change. One of the main reasons why we don't know yet a precise number is because climate change is not necessarily a singular individual a trigger for people to start migrating. It's among them, and usually it's collaborated with, for example, migrating for new economic opportunities or better education or sometimes for medical purposes. So climate change itself, it's worldwide, as you said, it's quite hard to fix in a very, very, very good number.
Mm-hmm.
What will be in the future? Well, that's even harder to predict because as you know, climate change is a process. It's an actual process. It happens now as we speak. Even if tomorrow we stop producing CO2 and we stop taking care of our environment the way we were supposed to do, it will continue for years to come. And as you said, it's a global effect. It affects the U.S. It affects all the continents. It affects all the countries in the world. And if it's not present yet, one day probably it will come. And with the climate change phenomenons coming as well, the migration, it will be an effect of it. In the hybrid law theory we developed in 2007, became the theory that migration is a subsidiary effect of climate change. So people at the beginning, when they face a climate change effect like sea level rise, erosion, flooding, or any kind of environmental degradation, their human right, the first effect would be that the human right is violated. The right to access to water, access to education. They cannot go to school take the kids to school. They don't have access to water. They have sometimes right to life because sometimes you have some fatalities as you had in Katrina and so on. And this, after this human right effect, the household, the people affected, the vulnerable people, and this is again a fact established by the scientists that the most vulnerable people in the world, in the poorest communities, are the first to be affected by climate change in general. They need to take a decision. And the decision at the household level, it's quite simple. We stay and we adapt, or we migrate. What we know today is that 30% and counting of the households decide to migrate. Mm-hmm. And this number is increasing mainly because the states do not have the capacity in some cases, or in other cases do not provide the adaptation people are expecting. They usually, for example, in Asia or Africa or even South Pacific, they're the head of the household take the decision, and they live together, or one of them is going to urban areas in order to provide more economic means for them to survive back home.
Mm-hmm.
So again, coming back to your question, it is quite hard to predict number. Numbers are just numbers. Again, it's important to know the numbers, of course. However, it's also important to know why and where.
Right. Later in the show, as you know, we're going to be talking about the first ever in the United States grant from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. They've put aside a lot of money to look at communities that need to rebuild their infrastructure because it's not strong enough to withstand flooding and storms, etc. This is the first allocation, and it's a lot of money, $48 million for this very small community, some 60 people, to move because their land, you can't grow anything on it, it's flooded all the time. And they're saying that this is a community struggling with the impact of climate change. Have there been other communities very close to the water all over the world, poorer communities, and this is Native American area, that have already had to move? Is there money available for that? Do we need to start planning resources to help those people move because there are so many complications associated with that? And do we need to start doing that now on a worldwide basis?
Well, as a matter of fact, you actually have in Alaska, as far as I know, in 2006, some indigenous communities on the west coast of Alaska. If I remember correctly, two names of the villages affected by climate change who already resettled in a very planned and organized way. The names are Kivalina and New Talk. I hope I'm pronouncing them correctly. They're indigenous communities, as I said. And they were already resettled, assisted by the state. All over the world, this kind of isolated situations, when you have by villages or communities, bigger or smaller, relocating from the coastal areas in particular, because they are one of the first to be affected, are just cases which are happening, and you have to treat them independently. Some countries do have the resources, like the U.S. The U.S. did a great job in Alaska, and the people from Louisiana could actually take a good example from the four or five villages which already resettled. It took a long time. It's a slow process. At the end of the day, we're talking about people. So the entire process has to be human-centered, which is so important. And sometimes you have some losses and some damages which you cannot count, and you cannot provide, even if you provide $1 billion in funding, it will not cover the cultural loss mm-hmm. or the local indigenous environment, which was developed in thousands and thousands of years. And all over the world, in the Pacific, for example, people started to move from the coastal areas inland, inside the land, preferably on higher ground, which is very hard to have actually in the Pacific. In Bangladesh, which is a huge delta country in the Southeast Asia, people are affected constantly by the floods and sea level rise. So it's a urban migration to the capital, to Dhaka, which provides actually the most economic opportunities in the country. And it's imagine an agglomeration of people coming from all over the south of Bangladesh to a very small city, unprepared to welcome so many people. But they are just going there because this is their only way.
Right.
And of course, most of the migration when it comes to climate change, it's happening internally within the country. So you have this relocation within the countries. But sooner or later, we're going to have to admit, and we're going to have to start discussing about international displacement and relocation, mm-hmm. that countries themselves will be so affected that they cannot represent a state and they cannot represent a location for people to live. And it's already happening. You have some islands, very, very small islands in South Pacific, which are affected, and villages are disappearing very quickly. And at the point, because they are very low lying, they will have to migrate to another country with a higher relief at the beginning, and then on the second step with bigger opportunities for them and their families. And this is a perpetual process which is happening all over the world. And as I said in my first point, was that you have the people migrating to urban areas, and then the second phase will be to go to other countries if that urban area do not satisfy their needs. But regarding the funding and the assistance of the state, this is something very particular for each state. I mean, the United States, it's a strong economy in the world, and they do afford even to have this $48 million for a small community like that to be relocated in order to make sure that they address all the needs and all the to cover eventually, not necessarily, like metaphorically, if you want, the losses people are leaving behind. Because in our institutional research we conducted in the Pacific, we discovered that there are people who do not want to move.
Sure.
And the Louisiana tribe you have in the article as an example, especially the old people, they don't want to move. And they have such a high land affinity that even if you are coming with a very strong financial motivation, it would be very, very hard for them to take the decision to move away.
Right.
And they're actually the ones left behind. Because the young people, again, one of our research projects proved that the young people are the ones who are already ready to move. And this is not necessarily the difficult target the states have to face when they are coming with the financial support. Because they will go to better education, better opportunities, they're on the move, they are more flexible. When you reach the segment of people over 50 or over 60, then you start having problems because the people, as I said, do not necessarily want to go.
Right.
And I'm not pretty sure how much the financial support will really, really address their needs. I think their needs will be just, let me enjoy my house as I used to for the last, I don't know,
right.
decade, or 2 decades, 5 decades, so long. And you have to come here and do something about our community to stay as we know it. So probably the first step the state will say will take in assisting these people will try to provide them adaptation plans for them to try to defend one way or another the community from the climate triggers. And sometimes this is as successful or on a short or medium, even when they are lucky, on the long term. But sometimes these adaptation plans do not necessarily work. And you have a recurring climate phenomenon coming in, and or a strong storm or again a flooding or something which is very sudden. And all the adaptation plans, when they are conducted with engineers, very, very sophisticated technology, my fate. And then you have to start thinking about relocating those people at a safe ground. I mean, you start with eviction, you start with evacuations, you start with moving people or installing early warning systems for the community to have in order to know when is the case for them to temporarily move and then eventually come back. But if, again, we go back to the Katrina example, we know very well that so many people never came back to the community because the community mainly is not the same. And even if they had that highland affinity I was talking about earlier, when they come back, they say, this is not my house.
Right, right. Doctor, thank you very much for giving us a worldwide perspective on this issue. Dr. Cosman Horendia joining us by phone today from Germany. You have a lot cut out for you, don't you, in the years ahead?
Yes, unfortunately, yes. Yes, we do have the work to do.
Yeah. He works as Associate Academic Office and Legal Expert at the United Nations University Institute for Environment and Human Security and is looking at the myriad of legal issues associated with environmental degradation and adverse effects on climate change. Marion McFadden joining us in just a moment, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Grant Programs at the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. We started the show talking about the Île de Jean-Charles in Louisiana, which is receiving the first grant to help the community, some 60 residents, resettle on terra firma. And they also have given $1.1 billion to 13 states to help communities adapt to climate change by building stronger levees, dams, and drainage systems. We'll hear about that as we continue. And welcome phone calls along the line here, too. So if you'd like to get your phones in now, that would be good. The number is 800-486-8655. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We'd love to read your comments about this issue as well. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And now, joining our conversation is Marion McFadden, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Grant Programs at the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. They're overseeing the department's National Disaster Resilience Grants. And before that, she was on HUD's Hurricane Sandy Rebuilding Task Force and the National Coalition for the Homeless. And we thank you very much for being with us, Marion. Good afternoon.
Thank you. Good afternoon to you.
Yeah. So as I understand it from the article in the International New York Times, this grant that you're giving, and it's quite a substantial grant, is to help many of the people in Île de Jean-Charles relocate to firmer ground because they just can't live where they are anymore?
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. They've actually seen 98% of their land lost because of sea level rise and subsidence.
Mm. And we're talking about Native American communities, two of them, I understand, hard to leave because your ancestors are buried there and because it's been your homeland for a long time.
There's certainly an attachment that people feel to their land when they've been there for multiple generations, and that's the case there in coastal Louisiana for sure.
So is the process already beginning? Have you talked to the residents there?
So the money is going from HUD, the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development, where I work. We're making a grant to the state of Louisiana, and they're working with residents on the island and having those conversations about relocating intentionally to a new place. And no one who lives there is going to be forced to relocate. So it's a process now of identifying what they can do with the money, what kind of a community that they can create, and how many people are interested.
Do you anticipate, and maybe you already have this in the works, that there will be other communities that need to resettle?
Well, it's certainly the case in different parts of the country that sea level rise is making it harder and harder for people to remain where they are. Coastal Alaska comes to mind in particular.
Mm-hmm.
So we are absolutely seeing more need for communities to relocate.
And have there been several, we were talking about that the first part of the show, several communities have had to relocate from Alaska farther inland just in the last few years?
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And we've also seen smaller scale relocation, particularly after some of the worst disasters, like Hurricane Sandy, for example, where not an entire community but an entire neighborhood choose to move rather than rebuild in a location where they just see that the writing's on the wall, that the storms are just going to get more intense and it would be more dangerous to stay
yeah.
and make the choice to move.
Hmm. And HUD gave $1 billion to 13 states in January. What is all that money for, and how did you identify those states, Marian?
So it's a funny thing. If you don't think about HUD when you think about disaster recovery, you're certainly not alone. We're kind of like this quiet billionaire on the stage of disaster recovery. People usually think about FEMA or the Department of Transportation or the Army Corps of Engineers. But after Hurricane Sandy, when Congress made funding available, they gave us this unique appropriation for disasters occurring in 2011 through 2013. So it wasn't just Hurricane Sandy recovery, but the entire nation actually proved to be eligible. We had about two-thirds of the counties in the United States had presidentially declared disasters over that three-year period. So when we had this $1 billion to allocate, we asked the question, how can we put this money to best use? How can we inspire people not to put things back the way they were, which clearly would be, you know, too dangerous to do if the same kind of storm came along, but to really inspire better thinking about resilience. And so that's how we determined that we would do a competition. And we invited the 48 states who had declared disasters, as well as the cities and counties that had had the worst disasters in that three-year period, to come in and compete for the funds.
You've been quoted as saying that you see this, what's happening in Louisiana, as setting a precedent for the rest of the country and really for the rest of the world. You're running the program for the Department of Housing and Urban Development. How much of this do you think will be taking place, and are we going to have the funds? Because this costs a lot of money to relocate not very many people. If indeed we're going to see much more of this, how are we going to afford to relocate people, and how do you even begin to plan for such a thing?
Well, I mean, I think it's certainly incontrovertible that the federal government does not have this kind of a funding level that would allow us to move every person who's facing risk from sea level rise, for example. So there aren't funds, and we can't expect funds to be available for that. But we're really being intentional about creating this project as a model that other communities can learn from and take pieces of. One of the things about the money coming to HUD is that it's designed to serve primarily people of modest means, people who don't have the resources to recover on their own. And so we're really conscious of the fact that these disasters are exposing that the people who are the most physically vulnerable are often the people who are the most socially vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. You say that you don't want to wait until people have lost their homes, until they flee and become refugees. The idea is to plan ahead with this community, mostly of Native Americans in Louisiana. 98% loss of your land is incredibly substantial. I'm wondering, when you look at other communities, because you have a handle on the whole country, are other communities in as dire a shape as this one?
Well, you know, we asked the states and the local governments to come in and tell us about the situations they're dealing with, and this particularly stood out. But I can't speak to every community that's at risk, but I would certainly say that we didn't find the single one that's most at risk, and so there are many others out there.
Let's welcome phone calls. We have several of them coming in. I'm sure we'll have quite a few as we continue here. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We're talking about the Department of Housing and Urban Development designating $1 billion. They designated this in January to help a community, states dealing with effects of climate change, bigger storms, more flooding, et cetera, and the first of its kind climate resilience grant to resettle the island's native residents in Île de Jean-Charles, Louisiana. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Carl in Madison, our first caller. Hi, Carl.
Yes, thank you again for an excellent and important program. The issue I'm concerned is that we are talking about adaptation on an issue that there just really won't be any possible level of adaptation to the kinds of climate changes we're going to see in the near future if we don't get a pretty good handle on the mitigation side and stopping dumping all of this CO2 into the atmosphere. To move a few people, God bless them, and I hope they get the resources they need to move, but this will cease to become news after a while as more and more communities, and soon as everybody living in a coastal region, will have to address these on a on a lifestyle level, but on a survival level. So I'd like to see a lot more focus put on how do we keep the greenhouse gases that are causing and driving all of this need to move from being put in the atmosphere, so that people, particularly indigenous communities that have a history of respect for the earth and care for the environment, they're bearing this on their shoulders. And I feel like this is a Band-Aid. And my concern is that while I applaud the effort to help any community in crisis, the larger message might be that we can fix this. And I don't think we can fix it simply by moving people.
Marion.
Yeah, I absolutely agree that this is the fix that this community needs right now. They, you know, every time a storm comes, it gets worse and less gets rebuilt. And so we are meeting their urgent need. But I absolutely agree with you on the larger point that more needs to be done to stop the trend.
So what do you think we need to be doing?
So I'm not a climate scientist, but I will say that focusing on using cars less is a great opportunity. Particularly, it makes a lot of sense with the population that HUD serves, low and moderate income people. And so we look for opportunities to put housing close to public transit and things like that, so that we can put less drain on the environment.
Mm-hmm. We hear some pretty dire warnings at times about what could happen to places like Florida, the coast along Florida, that millions of people, perhaps in the not-too-distant future, are going to have to move because all of those areas will be flooded. We've heard about Pacific Islands that already have been flooded. Do you have any models, and do we need models of what we're likely to encounter 10 years hence?
So that's something that NOAA in particular has been working on, and the federal government as a whole has tried to be cognizant of our role to use the best available science and data to present a clear picture of what's coming. I think we've made a lot of progress just over the course of the president's administration in stopping the conversation from being about whether this is true to how exactly it's going to impact individual communities.
Let's go next. Thank you, Carl, very much for your call. Jerry in Waukesha. Hi.
Good afternoon. Thanks for letting me contribute. I'm just curious, how does this relate or correspond to back in the 1900s when we were damming up rivers for hydroelectric and things like that, and people were being displaced then? Is this a little bit, are we doing a little bit of a better job trying to assist people that are moving around? Is it something we learned from, or... Is there any difference at all? Just wondering if there's kind of a correlation there.
I think that's a really great point, Jerry. I understand why people are talking about the residents of Île-de-Jean-Charles, for example, as climate refugees, but really we're attempting to be truly intentional about the way we move people. We've learned a lot as the federal government, and I think states and local governments have too, about the importance of taking care of people when moving them from one place to another. And here the goal is that the residents will have really the loudest voice in determining where they move and what the land looks like when they get there.
Where will people go? Do you know yet?
The state is looking at several different sites pretty close to Île-de-Jean-Charles and far enough away to be out of harm. But the goal is to get a large enough place that they can make housing available for the current residents of the island, as well as have a community center, and possibly in the long term make other opportunities available for people who have already been displaced from living on the island.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, it would have to be Native Americans who again have to move, right?
No, actually, that's not the case.
Oh, it's not the case.
This is a state-recognized tribe, not a federally recognized tribe.
Oh.
And so, actually, from HUD's perspective, we are serving all of the people who live on the island or have that connection to the island. It's not about membership in the tribe.
Mm-hmm. How many people live on the island?
As I understand, there are about 60 who live on the island currently.
Mm-hmm. And our previous guest was saying when you have a situation like this, about 30% of people say are willing to move, and it tends to be younger people, not older people. Do you just leave it up to the individuals? Do you want to stay? Do you try to convince them that it might be good to move, or how do you handle that?
So Chief Naquin, is leading the effort there, and he's working with the state as well as the Lowlander Center. And they are talking with residents and trying to build that consensus. And based on informal conversations, no one's been asked to kind of sign that they're ready to move. There's a very strong take-up. People are ready to go. There have been enough storms that they are really ready to move.
And then you have to deal with, I'm wondering if HUD is involved in this or the state of Louisiana, of the choice they may have in where they may go, whether or not they're going to be welcomed by the new community where they go to, whether or not there will be work in that community.
So most of the residents on the island are working off the island. So the goal is to be able to stay close enough that they can keep their existing jobs.
Let's go to more phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. Mary in Milwaukee is our next caller. Marion, hi, Mary.
Hello. So I would just like to recommend the documentary that you can get on Netflix. It's called Cowspiracy. And it talks about how, you know, you talked about transportation being the bigger issue for climate change. It is not. It is agriculture. We are destroying hundreds of thousands of rainforest acreage every day, and this is all in the name of agriculture. And in Brazil, over 1,110 people have been killed trying to stop this process in the last 10 years. And people are under the impression that it's all about, you know, cars and things like that. It's not. It's about agriculture and CAFOs, and that's what's destroying our environment. So I wish people would get that documentary and see it. It's quite an eye-opener, and Kathleen, I think it'd be a great topic for a show.
All right, thanks, Mary. I'm not familiar with the documentary. Are you, Marion?
I'm not, but I will certainly add it to my queue. Thanks for the recommendation.
Yeah, thanks very much. Let's also talk a little bit more about that $1 billion disaster resilience grant and the nation's infrastructure. How much improvement does there need to be to the nation's infrastructure, and what cities or areas do you really put at the top 10 or top 20?
So I'm not in a position to say who I think the top 10 or the top 20 are. We hear continuing demand for infrastructure funding from across the country. One of the programs that I oversee is the Community Development Block Grant Program, which provides funds to all the states and about 2,000 local governments across the country. I'm sorry, 1,200 across the country, and we hear continual demand, even for this $1 billion that we put out through the National Disaster Resilience Competition. We had $7 billion in requests.
Whoa!
There is a huge demand that we're not capable of meeting right now.
Well, what are we going to do about that?
Well, we tried to use the process of this competition in a way that would be valuable to all the competitors, not just the winners, and worked with them about thinking through how they incorporate resilience and infrastructure resilience into all of the projects that they're working on so that they can get multiple benefits from projects.
Yeah, the more we talk about this hour, the more I'm thinking we're just not really prepared for all of this to the extent that we need to be. Would you agree? And if so, why aren't we? Or if you agree, how are we?
Well, I mean, I think that one of the things about Americans is that we're kind of optimists, and we believe it's not going to happen to us until it happens to us. And so we haven't focused that much on disaster planning in communities that have not been struck by disasters. So that was one of the goals of this competition, is to leave a legacy of thinking about resilience so that it becomes just gut instinct to think about, well, in everything I'm planning, what's going to happen if we get hit by a natural disaster or some other threat?
Yeah, but so many parts of the country have been. We've had Sandy and Katrina and horrible forest fires and droughts. There have been all kinds of bad things happening, haven't there?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, disaster recovery is a growth industry.
Mm. Marion, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Marion McFadden is Deputy Assistant Secretary for Grant Programs at the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, and she is in charge of overseeing the National Disaster Resilience Grants. HUD announced that they were giving $1 billion to 13 states to help communities adapt to climate change by changing the infrastructure, building the levees to be stronger, the dams, and also the drainage systems. And there was a very interesting article in the International New York Times on May 2nd that focused on the first community that's going to be receiving $48 million. It's Île de Jean-Charles. It's in Louisiana, and it's a smaller community, but people are going to have to be moving because 98% of the land is just no good any longer. And there are a number of people who are having a very hard time getting to work because the bridge that goes to the mainland is rotted, and sometimes, you know, it's flooded, so you can't get to work, and there will be a number of people who will have to move. $48 million, this is the first ever kind of grant to move an entire community struggling with the impact of climate change. We'll speak with a member of the community as we continue here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joining us now is Boyo Billiot, who is deputy chief of the Biloxi Chitimaca Choctaw tribe located in Louisiana, and he is living in the very area that we have been talking about. Chief, thank you so much for being with us. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So tell me about the flooding situation, the loss of land in the area where I assume you now live. You haven't moved yet, have you?
Yes, ma'am. We moved out in 85.
Oh, you did move out?
Yes, ma'am, and because we was always getting flooded every couple of years. We had to start all over to rebuild, buy new furniture.
Oh.
So we figured we'd just move out.
So where did you go? Just to?
Homer, just about 25 miles north to Homer.
And did you have to do that at that point at your own expense? Did anybody help you with moving?
No, ma'am. I did that on my own expense.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So the people... And yeah, go ahead.
Was it? Yeah, I was listening to you. And it's not a bridge we have going to the island. It's a road. And the road, and when every time we have a south wind, the road is underwater.
Oh.
Because of the erosion. We don't have no more land around it. We just have the road. That's it. The road and the shoulder. They have rocks on the shoulders, but they don't have no more land around it at all.
Hmm.
So every time we get a strong south wind, the kids can't go to school because the bus don't want to pass on a flooded road.
Oh my!
And today we have a strong south wind, so the road is probably going to be flooded this afternoon.
So you obviously know people who are still living on Île de Jean-Charles. Do most people you know, now that there is grant money here, do they want to move as you did?
Oh, yes, ma'am. Almost at least 80% of the people want to move because my mom and dad still live on the island, and he always said that he was never going to move. And since we got the grant, I talked to him the other day. He said he's ready to move because it ain't going to be there too much longer because it's eroding away, and they can't get out when they want it. If they have an emergency, they can't get out.
Oh.
And they got to go get them by helicopter.
Oh.
But if the weather's bad, they can't fly, so they're stuck.
Right. What happened? Do you think it's due to climate change?
No, it's not. It's not just climate change. The saltwater intrusion. They dug canals for the oil field to bring oil rigs, and then the saltwater started coming in, and it's killed the vegetation. So the land eroded because they didn't have that vegetation to hold it together.
Uh-huh.
So it just eroded away.
They brought oil rigs into. Tell me more about that. What did they do?
No, just around. You know, like they have land rigs.
Yes.
Over here, down the bay, and they dig a canal, so they can bring the rig to it.
Mm-hmm.
And once the rig leaves, they don't go back and fill in the canal they dug. They just leave it, and they dug enough of them that the water kept on coming in, the salt water.
Mm-hmm.
So it killed all the vegetation, and your vegetation is what hold your soil together. After that, it just eroded away.
Hmm. And didn't anybody take them to task for having done that? Didn't they have to clean up after what they did?
They're supposed to.
They didn't.
But they don't. Nope, they don't. They didn't. And part of the climate change too, that has an effect on us too, because that now the tide is higher than it usually is.
Right.
You know, like back when I was growing up, back in the 60s and 70s, we didn't have no high water like we have now.
Mm-hmm.
Because of climate change and with the higher water table, so it. But. That's what happened.
Yeah, so it gets flooded all the time.
We on the island itself, it don't get flooded because they got a ring levee that to keep the water off of the island itself where the houses are.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't get to it when it got south wind, you can't get there because unless you want to pass your car in the water.
Right.
But when it gets too high, nobody can pass there. You got to go by boat. That's the only way you can get over there is by boat.
Wow. So how many people are living in that area right now? And at the moment, how are they making a living?
Like you said earlier, most of them don't work on the island.
Right.
They do have some fishermen there. So oyster fishermen, they got maybe two families of oyster fishermen.
Mm-hmm.
Which they go by boat, they fish around the island. They don't have to leave. But the people that have to leave, they either got to pass their car in the water or stay with a family member up the bay where they're high and dry. In fact, my sister lives down there with my mom and dad. And when they got high water that she came past, she stayed by our house over there so she can go back and forth to work.
Hmm. I've heard, and I'm not sure what this is all about, that there is some disagreement among the two tribes there when it comes to relocation. Can you explain that to me? Or
Well, really, they just have one tribe, but they got another tribe that tried to claim some of the members, but we have... Everybody is with us.
So there isn't any big disagreement about. I'm not sure.
We always do have a big disagreement with them every time something comes around, and they don't want the people to move because they claim them, and every time we've got a disaster like a hurricane and all, they get grants and all, they say they help them out, but they don't help nobody out.
I see. So the people who don't want to move, we were talking the first part of this hour with somebody from the United Nations who was discussing this on a worldwide level, and some Pacific Islanders who have had to move because the water levels are going up where they are. But there are a certain number of people, older people particularly, who just call that area home, and they just don't want to move. Their ancestors are buried there, and they just can't imagine living anywhere else. That doesn't seem to be the case for your parents. Is it the case for others you know that they just can't imagine leaving the area they've called home, no matter what shape it's in?
Well, yeah, it is, because, like I said, I moved off in 85, and I was born there. I was born and raised on the island. And I didn't want to leave because, like I said, that's the only place I knew. And my
right.
grandparents, all my relatives are buried there, the older ones. And when we moved, my son was 9 years old. And when we moved, that was hard for him because he had all his relatives and all around him. They always played around, and when he moved, it was a different community, a
right.
different school.
Mm-hmm.
and he had to adopt a different place.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of losing, instead of having to rebuild it every couple of years, we told him that was the best thing for us to do.
I can't imagine having to do that, to rebuild your house and get all your furniture every 2 years. I can't imagine that.
Yes, ma'am. Every time we have a major storm, we didn't have a major hurricane since 08. well, we had a couple of little ones, but it didn't do too much damage. But in 08 was the last big one that hit on the island.
Right.
And everybody had to start all over. They just take everything out of their house, put it at the road, and they got to start all over.
Hmm. I also read that logging may have been a problem, deforestation. Were there a lot of people coming in and cutting down trees?
No, not on the island. No. Ain't nobody coming cut no trees on the island, because they never have. They had a lot of trees, but it started eroding before that. The trees started dying off.
I see.
But years ago, they used to plant sugarcane, rice, and all on the island.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, but now we have, like in the back of where my mama's house is, they had trees long ways back when I was growing up. Now they don't have any trees at all. Oh. They got the levee, they got the protection levee, maybe 100 feet in the back of her house.
Oh, that must be so sad for you and for your family.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. We welcome, I don't mean to exclude our audience, we welcome your phone calls if you'd like to join the conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655. We're talking with Boyo Biliat, Deputy Chief of the Biloxi Chitimaca Choctaw Tribe. He left the island, as you heard him say, in 85 because they had to rebuild their home every 2 years. And we're talking this hour about people having to move because of climate change. The Ile de Jean Charles in Louisiana, this is the first HUD grant, $48 million for people who live there to move, allocation of federal dollars to move an entire community struggling with the impact of climate change. And our guest, the chief, is telling us that it's not only the ocean is rising and the storms are becoming more violent and more frequent, but it's also the oil rigs that forgot to clean up after themselves. And so the salt water has come onto the island and destroyed most of the crops. So we've got 98% of the land that can't be used, and it's reached a point where people simply have to be able to move. So we have a couple minutes here to welcome your phone calls for Chief Boyo Biliat. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. We also welcome your thoughts on our Facebook page about this very important, I think rather underreported story nationally and internationally, and that is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Let's go to Edward, our first caller for you, Chief. Edward is in Brookfield. Hi, Edward.
Hi, how are you? Thank you so much for having the chief on the show. I think this is a great example of how certain people can be disenfranchised and having to be relocated as a result of climate change. And I really feel for him, obviously, and many people around the world who are going through similar things. I just wanted to bring up, if I can, the technical solutions that we have available to us now as a society to fix a lot of the environment that we've loused up over the years. However, they might not necessarily be economically advantageous. They do have significant social and, of course, environmental benefits as well.
What are you talking about, Edward?
Well, as we have the technical means, for example, to enliven or enrich the environment around us as opposed to continue to destroy it. But it's our economic systems, and I believe Naomi Allen did a great job in her film, Capitalism, A Love Story, I believe it's Capitalism, A Love Story, where she spotlights in this documentary exactly how the capitalist system works specifically against, or it totally ignores all environmental and social costs.
Okay. Chief, what could we have done to have prevented all this?
Don't have no oil rigs and all in the marshlands, but another thing, all the people, almost all the people over here work in the oil industry.
Sure, yeah.
So it's like that double-edged sword. If you stop the oil for you, the people ain't gonna
There's
have
no
any
work.
So
right,
yeah, but see, it's like he's saying, they do have a method of rebuilding the land. They got suction dredge that they could put suction dredge off of the coast, and they could pump they can pump some dirt, some sand back in where it's washed away, but they say it's not feasible. Mm-hmm. It will cost too much just to save the amount of land that they got.
Mm. Well, it's costing a lot now, too, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It costs a lot. Back then, if they would have did that earlier, back in the probably about 10, 15 years ago, it would have been different.
Yeah.
It would have been cheaper.
Mm. We're out of time. All the best to you and your family and everybody who lives on the island. We'll be thinking about you.
All right. Thank you.
Deputy Chief of the Biloxi Chitimacha Choctaw Tribe, Chief Boyo Billiet, our guest. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this interesting and important show, and to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and then we are going to spend a whole hour talking about the Great Society and LBJ.